Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. Stocks finished the week up slightly. He tells us gasoline is starting to make its annual charge higher, while gold is just begging to break out. InsideTrackTrading.com president Eric Haddock looks at the cycles affecting stock markets, interest rates, bonds, gold, silver, crude, and even war. Editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite, Danielle Park, joins us to talk about interest rates, recession, lack of GDP growth, the risk of losing a serious chunk of your investments, and how to manage your risk exposure. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Welcome back to the show, Ross.
Good to be with you once again, Jim.
Ross, how do the stock markets end the week?
Choppy towards through the middle of the week, but right at the tail end, managed to eke out a decent little gain. Nothing to write home about, but, here we are, the middle of April, and what is usually the second best month of the year. It's got an upside bias, not running away by any means, but, just a methodical uptrend, and we've got NASDAQ still leading the way. We've got the index there pretty much at its best levels since back in September. And when you get the S&P and the Dow, they're managing to hold in, but primarily because you've just got a few of the big stocks, the Apples and the Microsofts, with their big weighting in the indices that are holding it together. So, for all that those stocks are helping out, they're still not managing to make new highs for the year, but the bias is there. So as we move through April into May, the old sell in May go away. We want to be very careful here. So it'll be time to for the shorter term investors to at least be looking to have some stop losses in here. And if things roll over, you don't want to write it down through the summer. Usually we get another decent buying opportunity somewhere out there around July for a little pop, and then the best one, as usually comes along, would be in October.
What's going on with crude?
Crude had that really nice bottom down at the $64 level. That matched all the signals we would look for down there is an oversold condition. The monthly charts gave us that sequential nine, which shows nine consecutive months of downside. And we got six of these examples going back over 30 years. You expect to get a 2 to 4 month rally out of that. So we've managed to push through resistance. We're now trading in that $80 to $82 range, and as long as we can hold 80, then I think you start to be talking about numbers that would start with a 9 instead of an 8. So give this thing some potential to move on the upside. There's nothing wrong that we can see in the charts right now, and the commitment of traders numbers. Had a very big short position as far as the specs were concerned. When we were down near the lows, they still haven't reduced those positions dramatically. So there's still, I think, some power underneath this thing to help it move. And, within the complex, we take a look at Nat Gas, which had a chance to base out here a couple of months ago, had a decent bounce from $2 up to $3, right back down to $2 again. That might try and do a base down here, but I don't see a big potential. The one that, seasonally is the nice run is the gasoline market. And that typically is a January-February low moving up into the spring. And we've had two nice corrections. The gasoline, both the futures contracts and the ETF, managing to eke out new highs for the year as of this week. So, you can still buy the dips on that one and look for a decent rally.
And we haven't even had the annual springtime refinery fire / explosion.
Right. I mean, who knows what's going to be on the horizon there, but there invariably, year after year, something comes along and creates a little, the opportunity for a spike. And if something like that happens and you're long, you want to take your money off the table.
What's going on with gold?
Gold is just up there testing that 2000 to 2080 level. This is part of this pattern of big cup and saucer that we've had since 2011 when gold got up to these levels and then backed off badly. So we've now had three attempts to push through this resistance. There's probably one more pause before it's capable of breaking out. I think a decent pullback here could last a couple of months, but once we finally get through 2100, we got some pretty good numbers on the upside. The potential here, we take a look at it, the style of this consolidation, let's call it, since 2011, is the same type of thing that we saw prior to the breakout in 2008, 2009, when gold was trying to get through $1,000. And back then, it had three declining highs before it managed to break out. And if we look back even further to when gold broke out through the $190 to $200 level back in the 1970s, that was a similar style to what we're seeing here as well. So this test of resistance is definitely sort of something that we've seen before, and it's just a matter of how well it wants to hold up on the corrections. At this point, clearly there is lots of potential on the upside if it wants to go. And, some people have been thinking it would be all maybe U.S. dollar related. And if we look back to those other examples, it wouldn't take much of a decline in the U.S. dollar, maybe 5% or so, to allow gold to have a pretty good spurt on the upside.
Ross, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Pleasure to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Coming up, Eric Haddock next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Eric Haddock, CEO and president of InsideTrackTrading.com. He's speaking to us from Central California. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Oh, well, thanks for having me back, Jim.
Eric, we're coming up on what you call the date of aggression. Can you explain what that is and what it might mean for the markets?
Yeah, that's one that there's a lot to unpack there. But very simply put, actually, let me answer that in reverse. As far as the markets, there are some key markets that have corroborating cycles coming into play this year. Last year at that time, and it's the date of April 19th. I'll go back to that in a minute. But that's what I call the date of aggression. I also monitor the week of aggression surrounding that date. And a perfect example was last year when there were a lot of corroborating cycles in gold market and in the Dow Jones Industrial Average that were showing those markets should rebound into a peak there and then see some pretty sharp sell-offs afterwards. And that was pretty much exactly when both of them topped and never returned to those highs throughout the rest of the year. And there's some related markets that, not those two, but other markets that are showing similar things this year. But going back to the origin of that date and the significance of it, it's something I started writing about in the 1990s, and it's been known by different things in our culture, particularly here in America. In the Northeast, it's known as Patriots Day. And the big reason for that is that the first shot of the Revolutionary War took place on April 19th, 1775. And that date, as you go through America's history, but also around the world and with major events, usually events of aggression, that date times a lot of those things. But just looking at America's history, it's funny how many times the first shot in major wars and a couple times the final shot was fired right along with that time frame. Even with the Revolutionary War that 8 years later, April 18th, 1783 is when they date the fighting ceasing in that war. But moving ahead a little bit, the final shot Battle of San Jacinto and the end of the Texas Revolution came right at that date in 1836. A few days, get into this where I also watched the week surrounding it, but a few days after that date was in 1846 was the Thornton Affair and the first shot of the Mexican-American War. Few years after that, April 19th, 1861 was the Baltimore riot and was the first shot of the Civil War. Ironically, 4 years later, it was just a couple days before that date that Lincoln was shot and killed. When you go to the end of that century, April 19th, 20th was the congressional resolution that initiated the Spanish-American War. And you just go, like I said, you go on and on throughout our history, and you see that date just coming up again and again. In the last century, April 19th, 1961 was the day the Bay of Pigs invasion failed. Just a couple days after that April 19th date was the end of the Vietnam War in 1975. And then in 1988, you had Operation Praying Mantis, which was between the U.S. and Iran was the largest battle of surface warships since World War II. But then as you moved into last few decades, it started the time an eerie series of more domestic attacks, aggression, and domestic terrorist events, including the Waco Branch Davidian debacle. The Oklahoma City bombing was right on that date. The Columbine High School massacre was on April 20th. The Virginia Tech shooting was, I think, a couple days earlier than that. And it has been something that has just timed these events of aggression. And in the last 10 years, you had in 2013, April 15th was the Boston Marathon bombing, and then April 19th was when martial law was invoked in Waterton, Massachusetts, and they ended up capturing those bombing suspects. At the same time, in April 2013, you had a terrorist attack on a major power station in Northern California, that you still never hear the complete resolution of what happened with that, the Metcalf Power Station. So in the last couple decades, it has timed a lot of domestic events within America. And there's a lot of different history that goes into that time frame, not just from a geopolitical standpoint, but I've described it, and I won't go into too much of it here because it would take, you know, I could go for hours discussing this, but it also incorporates some very significant measures of time and timing throughout different cultures over thousands of years. It has astrological and astronomical significance. It even has some very, not ominous, but pretty significant war and sacrifice events back in thousands of years past. So it's something that just keeps having this recurring significance. And so I look for both, excuse me, external events from the market, particularly when there are other cycles coming into play. It's that synergy that really kind of piques my focus and attention. It's not that every year something needs to happen on that date, but it's when there is a lot of synergy of other events coming into play that I think that has greater significance and greater cause for being monitored much more closely. So that is what I call the date of aggression, for I hope obvious reasons now that I've explained that. But as I said, there's been some recurring market significance as well, and that's why there are key markets where I think that could tie in some pretty significant turning points this year.
So far, your longer-term outlook for interest rates has been right on. When is the next phase of that four-year cycle, and what does it mean for bonds?
Yeah, that four-year cycle has been one of the most consistent and uncanny cycles in bonds and interest rates. And I talked about it back in 2020 when everything was showing a major top in bonds and a major low in interest rates. And it had timed peaks in bonds in July of 2012, July of 2016, and was coming up on July of 2020 when I thought we would see the final top in bonds. But the next, and that is what occurred, but the next phase of it is in middle of 2024, looking right around that July timeframe again. But when you see a cycle like that, particularly the phase that it's in right now, you have to kind of look at how the wave structure is. And so at different phases along a cycle, the decline and rally that are between those cycle peaks alternates in duration. So sometimes the decline after a cycle peak like that only takes a short period of the time, maybe 20-25% of that cycle, and then a new uptrend follows it. Other times, it's just the opposite of that. But where we are right now in this cycle, everything was showing that bonds should decline for about two-thirds of that cycle, of that four-year cycle, and then rally for the final third of it. And that kind of gives you what's basically a 50% rebound in time. So for that to occur, bonds needed to decline for roughly 32 months, which brought them into March of 2023, and set a bottom at that time, and then rebound for 16 months. So down 32 months, up 16 months, until it hits a secondary top. So that is what bonds are looking like they're doing. They sold off into a four-year cycle that was between specific lows back in October of 2022. And then they had another sell-off into March of this year with the short end of the curve spiking to new lows, middle of the curve kind of making a double bottom, and the long end of the curve making a slightly higher low, a type of divergence that you often see at major turning points. And that was a important signal to me that bonds are setting a bottom and interest rates, the corresponding interest rates, are setting a top. And so what I would expect from there is to see some bottoming action. Just because a low is intact doesn't mean a market immediately rallies sharply from there. In fact, very often, the biggest rallies are just before and leading into cycle highs, and the biggest declines are leading into and right at cycle lows. So you need a bottoming phase to take place, but what it's showing me is that we could see interest rates top out here and then on balance move steady to lower into the middle of next year. And there's other markets that are already beginning to corroborate some of that outlook. So that's what I'm watching right now on a longer term basis, and on an intermediate term, bonds since bottoming in March, we're showing an expected rally up into the second half of April. And that's when I think we will see an initial high, but that'll just be the first phase of a developing uptrend in bonds.
Last September, your work predicted a major rally in gold and silver. What went into that analysis, and what's the outlook for the rest of this year?
Gold and silver were completing what I perceived to be 1 to 2 year corrections from their 2020 and 2021 highs. Gold traced out what sometimes be called a flat correction, where it sets its initial peak, sells off pretty sharply, then goes right back up and sets a second peak at almost the same level as the first one, then sells off and sets a second low almost at the same level as the preceding low. That's a flat correction because if you draw parallel lines between the highs and the lows, you basically just see a flat, a parallelogram going horizontal. And usually you get a strong rally come from that because the market has tried to correct. And there were other things like the strong move up in the dollar and strong move up in interest rates, both of which usually are very bearish for gold, and they did have a bearish effect on gold. But if you look at its 5 to 10 year trend, it really was just a moderate correction and kind of treading water until those things, the interest rates and the dollar surges, began to peak. And that leads the way for a strong rally to follow that type of correction. And at the same time, silver was fulfilling some major cycle lows that came into play in September of last year and had also fulfilled, both of them had fulfilled wave targets to the downside, both in price and timing. There was just a strong convergence of price and timing indicators. So that's why I, not only in my publications, but some extra reports explained why gold and silver were setting this low and that they should see initial 3 to 4 month rallies into the early part of 2023. And then they pulled back into early March. Gold triggered a weekly buy signal on March 5th and then followed it up with a convincing daily buy signal on March 8th. And at the same time, silver was fulfilling everything necessary from a wave two or wave B pullback. Basically, you have your initial surge and then a pullback. It was fulfilling everything necessary for that. And that was when both metals generated a new roughly two-month buy signal that has been expected to take them up into early May. Just recently I published an update to some of that analysis and explained some of what this means for the coming months and even years in gold and silver. And in fact, that report, gold, silver, and Elliott Wave structure is available to all new subscribers. But that is something that details not just the outlook for gold and silver, but it also shows what I have been calling the sweet spot where inflation is concerned. And like I just mentioned, often when you get inflation taking hold, as we had the last couple years, you get two immediate perceptions, perceived responses to that. One is strength in the dollar. Actually, I should put that as the second one. The first one is that interest rates start to go up or they start to expect them to go up. Either one of those has the same effect on the market because the markets are really based on perception as much as they are reality. So you first get this perception that interest rates are now starting to head in a positive direction, and that often leads to the second one, the dollar starting to gain against other currencies. And both of those factors are typically a negative for gold. Higher interest rates go into holding costs and other factors that suppress the value of gold. So even though you've got inflation, which a lot of people want to make a clean correlation between if inflation's going up, gold goes up, silver goes up, it's only certain phases of that inflationary cycle that are bullish for gold and silver. So in that beginning stage, or really the primary stage, you've got inflation going up, but in response, you've got two things that are big burdens on the price of gold, higher interest rates and higher dollar. But as you get to a phase in the middle, even a little beyond the middle of that inflationary cycle, that's when you get the sweet spot for gold and silver. And that was what I described last September, October, November, when you had the initial bottom in bonds, which was an initial high in the corresponding interest rates. Even though the Fed continues to bump up short-term interest rates on a six-week basis, the broader and what the market is perceiving from interest rates and the longer-term interest rates are different from that. So right as you had interest rates setting that initial peak when measured by bonds, and the dollar was setting a major peak back in late third, early fourth quarter of last year, that began to take this big pressure off of gold and silver. And that's when gold and silver enter the time frame when you still have all of that underlying inflation. It's still there. Now, even, you know, with the recent CPI and PPI data, they're saying that, okay, inflation either leveling off or going down. Yeah, on a month-to-month basis or a year-to-year, it's not even the year-to-year basis, on a month-to-month basis. But inflation is still very much there, still very much at its high point. It's just not accelerating higher as it had in the months and year before. And so that's another one of those things that really helps to support gold and silver, because the inflation's still there, but now the interest rates have kind of run their course, the dollar has run its course, and so it's like two big burdens have just been lifted off of gold and silver, and that's where we are now.
You've often talked about the energy and equity connection. Can you elaborate on that and what it means for oil prices and stock prices in the coming months?
Yeah, one of those, that correlation is often a pretty well accepted one, that you will often see energy prices and stock market moving in relatively in tandem. And of course, that reflects basic things like a growing economy. So you've got more demand for energy, and at the same time, you've got stock values going up. But then at turning points, you also see a leading and lagging effect go between those two. And I think we had talked about in a couple of our more recent discussions where all of my work was showing that the oil and gas index, the XOI index, was on track for a major top in January of 2023. And all it needed to do was go back up and retest the highs that it set a few months earlier. And that would fulfill the entire wave structure. It would fulfill the cycles. And that's what we saw in January. And that index was peaking right about the time that a lot of your other stock indexes had seen another 2 to 4 week rally and were peaking. But that's where the energy markets, I believe, especially the stocks related to that, began to turn a corner. And I think that that's a broader top that is unfolding in them that's going to have some interesting ramifications over the next 3 to 6 months. And so along with that, crude oil and natural gas and all of your energy markets continued to sell off into March. And then some intermediate cycles were telling me to look for a rebound into the current week, basically April 10th to the 14th, maybe stretching a couple days into next week, but that's when I expect to see a secondary top in crude and unleaded gas on an intermediate basis and another downturn from there. And I'm kind of watching because there's certain stock indexes that are also showing we could see an intermediate peak next week. But that's the type of thing where the market that's kind of lagging, in this case, the energy index, the XOI index, where often that will have a sharper sell-off once the other markets peak. It's what I often correlate to an analogy of an old wooden roller coaster where each of the cars has to get over the peak before the lead one can really start accelerating to the downside. And so you've got that correlation that continues to play out, but there's some, like I said, some very interesting setup for particularly that index, but also the energy markets over the coming weeks and months.
Where can listeners get more information on Inside Track and the weekly relay?
Any of your listeners can go to our primary website, insidetracktrading.com. That's inside with the extra I in the middle, INSIIDE, tracktrading.com. And there's a lot of samples on there, a lot of archived reports, and also information about our various subscriptions and the publications we offer that they can find out all the information they need there.
Eric, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thanks for having me back, Jim.
My guest has been Eric Haddock, CEO and President of InsideTrackTrading.com. He was speaking to us from Central California. Coming up, Danielle Park, next on This Week in Money.
Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her website's jugglingdynamite.com and venablepark.com. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Hey, thank you, Jim.
This week, the Bank of Canada left the bank rate unchanged at 4.5%. What do you see ahead for interest rates?
Well, the futures market, more importantly than my estimate, is the consensus vote of all of the participants that are experts in the area of interest rates. So you take a combination of all those opinions and reflect that in the various yield curves as well as in the pricing of futures. So what we see is that there's a distinct difference right now between the U.S. Fed's policy and the Bank of Canada's policy. it matters to us a lot what's happening with the U.S. Fed and with the U.S. economy. But if we just sort of bifurcate that for a second, the U.S. Fed, there's currently a 80% chance priced in that they're going to do a 0.25 hike on May 3rd and that that will be the last hike of this cycle. And then the expectation or the pricing is for 100 basis points of cuts starting in June. So June's not far from now, Jim. And the reason for that is that both the Bank of Canada and the U.S. Fed implicitly in their forecasts have a recession starting in about June of this year, so the second quarter of 2023. The Bank of Canada has seen this coming, and they have they actually were on hold for their second meeting recently. So that means that they've paused officially, and when they paused in March, we thought that it was going to be a permanent condition, i.e. no more rate hikes this cycle. They didn't say that that would be the last, but they're playing it by ear, so to speak. So at this point, again, because the Bank of Canada is only forecasting GDP growth of 1.4% in 23 and even less in 2024 at 1.3%, we know that historically when Canadian GDP growth has been in that range of around 1%, the Bank of Canada has responded with rate cuts of about 200 basis points. So if you're at 4.5 today, Jim, that would suggest that they will be cutting to at least 2.5 over the perhaps next 12 months. And, you know, the other really startling thing in that forecast from the Bank of Canada is the reality that the Canadian government is forecasting year-over-year population growth of 1.8% in 23 and 1.3% in 2024. So within the context of that robust population growth, which is the highest of any developed nation, you're actually going to see a decline in per capita GDP. So this is a very negative trend for the overall economy when you have more people, more potential workers, but less output and less spending per capita. So it's a bleak picture. The IMF also had a update for global GDP this week, and they came out with a forecast lowering their expectations for the world GDP to 3% for 23 and also about that for 2024. So I think the bottom line here is this is not a blip or a short-term downtrend. This is likely to be weakness that will persist for the next 12 to 24 months, not just in Canada and America, but in the world. So this is all very relevant, of course, in terms of expectations around what kind of demand picture for exports, for commodities, for all of the things that sort of make the economy tick. Anyway, so the other thing about the IMF is they had a 25% chance of a severe economic downturn is in their forecast. So that's very high. If you know this group, they tend to be fairly conservative. So to have a 1 in 4 chance of what they call a severe economic downturn where GDP growth is 2%, they also say there's a 15% chance that global growth will be 1%. This is a great financial crisis style GDP growth. This is 2008 style. You know, we called that the Great Recession. This is the kind of outlook that these numbers would suggest for the next 2 years. So again, that's likely to mean that we're, you know, the U.S. Fed's still talking a good talk, saying they want to continue hiking and don't see any rate cuts this year. That was their latest missive that they came out with in March. There were a few members of the committee, three members, in fact, in the last week, who have mentioned that a little more dovish comments as GDP data and the employment picture starts to darken. So I think that, you know, at the same time, the U.S. Fed intends to keep running down its balance sheet, letting the assets it bought during QE, the liquidity it pumped into the system over the prior decade, really, coming into this year, they are still intending to keep withdrawing that from the system. So the thing is, even if they pause in their rate hiking moves, as is now expected potentially in May, they still hope to keep withdrawing from the liquidity from the banking system through the reversal of this quantitative easing, so quantitative tapering. So all of that really speaks to why there's been weakness in the U.S. dollar in the last little while, as against the euro, for example, where the European Central Bank continues to say that they expect to keep hiking rates. Now, The European Central Bank has a terrible record for getting this stuff wrong. The last time they were this divergent from monetary policy with respect to the U.S. Fed was in like 2008 and 2011. Both of them were big mistakes on the part of the ECB, and they quickly went to cutting again. So they have a bad track record. But in any event, that's why we've seen relative weakness in the U.S. dollar as it has sold off against some of the benchmark currencies, because that's the currency market saying they expect that the Fed is near the end of its tightening cycle. That and the bond market has also been saying that since about October, because government bonds have been rallying in price, which means longer dated yields have come down. And we can talk about that further with respect to the yield curve.
Yeah, are yield curves concerning?
Yeah, so they're the most, the U.S. curve right now, the 10-year yield on government bonds minus the 3-month yield is the most negative spread. It's a negative 1.67% today. That's the most negative spread on record for decades. It's also a negative spread on that, you know, irrespective of the depth of it, just a negative spread period on that between 10 years. And that means, for example, that the 3-month Treasury is yielding that much more than the 10-year. And in a normal environment, in a healthy expanding economy, you would see short-term interest rates be lower than long-term interest rates. In an unhealthy economy heading into a recession, you see that central banks have hiked rates on the short end so much that they have made them much higher, slowing the economy, which then the bond market looks and says, oh boy, you're slowing the economy so much, we're going to have a downturn, we're going to have a recession, you're going to be back to cutting rates before too long. And that is when they start buying the longer part of the yield curve, and that's why you get a negative spread. So it's every time we've had this negative spread in this particular, between these two points, you've had a recession in the past. This just goes into another one of these leading indicators of this ongoing downturn. So we now have had confirmation in the leading indicators have been negative for many months. The coincident indicators are also now signaling a recession starting probably about midway through this year in June or so. And now we're just waiting for leading economic indicators like unemployment, for example, which is very lagging. We're just waiting for that particular metric to start to rise, which then, you know, confirms the recession. But by the time that happens, you're already well within it historically.
Are banks constricting credit?
Yes. So the, you know, we knew that M2 was crashing. So the velocity of money through the economy, again, central banks can pump liquidity into the financial system, but they can't force banks to make loans. And in over the last couple of years, we saw this downturn in the willingness of banks to make loans into the real economy, both because they couldn't see, you know, good risk-adjusted proposals for businesses. Not many businesses were seeing a good case for expansion, so banks were reticent to lend. And then, of course, we had this big spike in the interest rates on those loans, which means banks are now concerned about the ability to collect the loans they've already made as the economy goes into a downturn. So they are tightening their lending standards, meaning they're offering less loans. And they're also, they've increased the rates, of course, significantly, all at the same time as deposits have been fleeing. So we spoke about this not too long ago, but you've seen the fastest rate of banks losing deposits out of their out of accounts as customers shift money to higher yielding places like GICs, government bonds, T-bills, you know, high interest savings accounts. All these things are paying yields in excess of 4.5% or so. So customers that were earning next to nothing have been moving money out of the bank deposits. That's the cheapest source of loan funding for banks is those deposits, and they've been paying people almost nothing on them, so they were making a fat spread. So now, of course, as they lose those deposits, they lose the ability to make loans on that as a fraction of those deposits. So that part is one of the reasons that that banks are contracting credit. But now what we see is the Senior Loan Officer Survey, which is the U.S. Fed does this survey and asks about the lending conditions. And in the third quarter in the recent quarter, it was the most negative that we've seen since the third quarter of 2020. So that was during the COVID lockdown. So again, just another indicator that the real economy is sputtering and that there is a lot of strain in the debt markets.
What's happening in the labor market?
So unemployment rates, of course, are, as I said, they're a lagging economic indicator. They take a long time to move down and they take a long time to move up. And they have continued near very historic lows, about 5% in Canada, 3.4% in the U.S. In Canada, the 5% was the fourth consecutive month with unemployment at that level. But what we notice is that we're starting to see, again, the more coincident indications of the employment market are looking quite negative. So we do have contraction in manufacturing and construction jobs, for example, in the month of March. That's a very economically significant sectors. They drive a lot of the growth and consumption and demand in the economy through the construction and manufacturing. So to see a contraction in those job sectors is quite a leading suggestion of where this is headed. But also the average work week, the U.S. average work week in the latest data was 34.3 hours. That's the lowest again since April 20, Jim, when again, you know, we were in the COVID lockdown. So what companies do, and particularly this time coming off of the COVID problems where there was a deficit of workers in many sectors, by the time employers were able to fill those positions and attract employees, they've been very reticent to cut, right? They've been very concerned about not laying people off and then having a hard time finding workers again. So they've kept them on. But what we have seen a slowdown here is in the amount of overtime that's being worked, the amount of hours that are being worked, the amount of full-time jobs that are now being offered. You're seeing a downturn in the amount of part-time positions. When you hire temporary workers is what I mean. The amount of temporary workers that are being hired, those hours are coming off. So all of these are more leading indicators of the overall employment picture. And small business plans to hire over the next 6 months have fallen to just 15% in March. That, again, the lowest since May of 2020. So these sort of give you an indication. Also, you know, this time there was, during the COVID downturn and recession, which was so short-lived, the bulk of jobs, as you know, that were lost were in the front-facing service hospitality sector. And white-collar jobs were typically maintained. People were able to work from home and that sort of thing. But there was also a big boom in the tech sector, right? So that drove a lot of jobs in the tech sector. Well, that was a leading portion or sector of the overall economy for sure. And what we're seeing is that is where the bulk of the layoffs are now coming from. So these are the high-paying jobs that are being laid off. The tech sector has laid off more than 500,000 workers so far just in the last year, and those people are starting to, we're starting to see that show up in less demand for housing, for example, in many hotspots like Silicon Valley, San Francisco area. Home prices are off already about 20% there. That's indicia of this downturn in employment and income in that sector. It's likely to continue. The other thing that we know about that is that we have, as I said, these leading economic indicators have been in a downturn now for many consecutive months, and that typically leads to rising unemployment. So traditionally, when you see that Fed tightening cycle, starts to shut down on these leading economic indicators, and that ultimately leads to rising unemployment.
Does it look like the stock markets are climbing a wall of worry?
They're actually, it's a very interesting, good old-fashioned bear market, as I've called it before, because it's not a quick downturn or anything like people are are used to seeing, for example, during the COVID sell-off or even during the 2018 temper tantrum or taper tantrum when markets sold off abruptly and then recovered sharply, this is a long, drawn-out affair. And if you look back, it's really been going on already a couple of years, but there's been a series of very vigorous rallies within this longer-term downtrend. And so, you know, the bulls in the latest investor intelligence survey were still above 48%. That's the highest since February. And the average stock allocations were still above 60% in retail portfolios. So we know historically that you won't get a market bottom until that bullish sentiment is crushed into submission much lower as a percentage of overall sentiment, and bears become sort of the dominant group, and that is not the case yet. Also, when equity allocations fall back to more like 40%, that's indicative typically of a bear market bottom. So we're not anywhere close to that. You know, 16 months into the S&P's, since the S&P's peak, you've got a smooth 10-year price-to-earnings ratio at 29, Jim. That's higher than 90% of the last indices in the last 140 years. So we're still, you know, the average forward price-to-earnings ratio for the S&P is about 19 times right now. It's been 18.5 typically at past cycle peaks since about 1960. So it's remarkable. We have had, you know, a lot of downside on some of the key sectors, but how little has really been accomplished in terms of repricing here is quite shocking. And the thing is, the average earnings estimate for the S&P 500 companies, which tend to be a bellwether, a leader, or an indicia of overall sentiment and pricing for overall markets, you know, in Canada and elsewhere, but the average consensus view right now on S&P earnings for 2023 are still above $230 a share, Jim. Well, you know, we know, and we've got a base case here of a recession in the second half of 23. We know that recessions typically take 20% off S&P earnings on average. And if that happens, then the current valuation on stocks, clearly, as high as it is on a backward-looking indicator, even if we look at what they expect forward earnings to be, it's still, you know, much higher than 19 times. And already about 80 S&P 500 companies have issued negative forward earnings guidance, so that's kind of a high watermark or a step in that direction of this disappointing trend coming. But we know that stocks don't historically bottom until earnings are near the end of their contraction. And like I say, we're barely off the peak here. So it's the other thing that's really important, I think, for people to appreciate is that the bulk of stock market losses historically have never come before the Fed started their rate cuts. So in other words, people that are thinking, oh yeah, sure, so, you know, some sectors are off considerably, that's great, but that means, you know, that the stock market has already discounted this incoming recession and they see the Fed going back to cutting soon and all will be well. Well, the reality is that the bulk of the losses always come once the U.S. Fed stops hiking, the pause, and then typically within 4.7 months on average, and sometimes shorter or longer, they start their cutting. And the stock market does not bottom historically until we're near the end of that cutting. So it's important to keep that context in mind when you realize how the base case has moved towards this contracting growth and therefore the losses we've seen in the stock market. And it's interesting, like bank shares in the U.S. are off about 38% from their peak, consumer discretionary about 31%, real estate shares are off about 28%, transports are down about 32%, small cap stocks, which tend to be very economically sensitive, are off about 26%. You know, you see the Canadian financials have significant catching down to do here because they're only off about 18% to date. Oil and gas producers about 13%. Our Canadian REITs are off about 19% from the peak. But when you consider that these are major components, like financials in particular are almost a third of the TSX index, which most portfolios mimic, and you're looking at them perhaps down half of what their overall decline this cycle could be, you can see that there's a lot of vulnerability in the overall basket. And the thing is that the the you know, if we got a 20% reduction in the earnings ratio, the earnings per share for something like the S&P companies, because we're coming off such record high levels when they had inflationary impulses and all this pent-up demand and extra money that really boosted earnings to record highs during, you know, into 2022, just having that contract 20% from there would still take the average earnings per share down to about 180. And if you apply any kind of a regular multiple to that of around 15, you're looking at an S&P around 2,700, Jim, and it's currently, you know, just under 4,000. So it's, we're not through the downturn, and we're not through the repricing likely to follow in the equity market.
How big is the bond market, and what do you see ahead for bonds?
Well, the global bond market is, you know, massive. It's in excess of $130 trillion. And its market cap has been always much bigger than equities. But if you look at it comparatively today, it's interesting because during the rate shock of 2022, we had the fastest hiking cycle in history, the big rate shock in the world. Assets sold off. Bonds sold off the most, right, relatively speaking, and compared to their historical volatility, they had the worst year in decades. So what you came into 2023 with was stocks still significantly overvalued and bonds significantly underpriced relative to historical norms. So sure enough, year to date, we've had, you know, the best start to any year for bonds in many decades. And they've been appreciating, government bonds have been appreciating since October. I've talked before about the importance to delineate between different types of credit quality when you talk about bonds. You can't talk about them as one cohesive unit because there's junk debt in there, there's debt that will never be repaid that's, you know, very sketchy, and then there's treasury market bonds from issued from government short-term paper and that sort of thing, which has the lowest default risk. So if you look at this point in the cycle, the junky stuff tends to perform with the equity market, so it's got significantly further downside here as all of this, the default cycle has begun. You know, that's all starting to rise. We're getting write-offs. We're getting companies handing back keys to buildings and not paying their loans. The mortgage-backed security market, all this stuff is really in a shocking state of disarray at the moment. But the actual treasury market itself has been getting the bid and attracting flows from investors, and that is likely to continue as we go into this recessionary period. As I described, this is when government bonds always typically outperform other asset classes, and they do that right until kind of, you know, stocks tend to bottom right around just as earnings have sort of bottomed, as the recession is kind of ubiquitous and everyone's very pessimistic, and the central banks are basically nearly done their easing efforts. That's when you typically get a bottom in the stock market. No one, very few people recognize it at the time because everyone's so universally bearish at that point. But that tends to be the awesome buying opportunity. It also tends to be the time when government bonds have appreciated the most, and they're an opportunity to take some of the longer dated issues and move money to shorter issues, taking some capital gains and reallocating your risk there. So that opportunity is coming potentially in the next 12 months as these trends play out.
Do higher mortgage rates seem to be affecting home prices?
Well, for sure, and they should, right? If you think about it, wage growth has not kept up with the cost of living increases now for a record 24 consecutive months, and a great deal of that has been to do with shelter, right? The cost of shelter, whether it be rented or owned, has been, you know, the metrics don't favor buying over renting in most cities today. If you can find a rental, I know there's not great supply, or hasn't been, although that's improving. But basically, the math of buying has been very negative relative to the math of renting, just because the principal portion got so inflated. And then when you add in much higher interest rates, all of a sudden the carrying costs, I mean, just in, you know, as an example, in the U.S., qualifying income to buy the average home in America today is over $86,000, and it was $47,000 you know, in February of 2020. And, you know, similar math has applied even worse in Canada. So what that means is that there's just, you come to the end of the tether of the ability of anyone to buy a home in those conditions because they don't have that kind of income, or they're already, you know, putting 60% or 70% of their household income towards just the shelter itself. So necessarily they have less to spend on everything else, and it's a very tenuous scenario. So we're starting to see property prices come off. I think I mentioned in places like California and New York, and I get a kick out of the general view that, you know, rich people don't have any problem in these downturns, or that the richest areas won't see any weakness, or, you know, cottage country will be protected. None of that is true, of course, because people with the highest incomes also tend to carry the highest leverage, whether that's in funds they've borrowed for their homes, their recreation properties, but also for their businesses, also for margin accounts, investments. You know, they tend to be the most highly leveraged. So when you get into a downturn of both the revenue streams and the earnings, that takes a hit at the same time that their cost of borrowing has leapt so much. Many properties were bought on, you know, even ones that were so-called investments were bought with poor or negative carrying costs back when prices were at the peak. And so a lot of that debt is coming up for renewal. In Canada, of course, many people have had variable rate mortgages, which have floated up during the past year. But but we also have an awful lot in fixed term mortgages, and that those start to come up for renewal, you know, a year, in the next year and two and three. So all of that, they're facing, you know, a much higher mortgage rates than what they typically took them out at during the pandemic. Also, it's spreading to the commercial property sector, and it's all connected, right? So the commercial property sector is in a terrible state of affairs because they had so much of this free, mindless money flowing in from so-called investors, from private equity, venture capital. You know, it was considered a no-brainer to borrow a ton at cheap rates and buy up everything in sight. Well, now, you know, a lot of those properties have had also a down, vacancy rates have fallen across the board in commercial properties, especially in the office space. And as those debts come up, you know, some $1.4 trillion of commercial loans has to be refinanced between now and 2025. That's about 25% of the commercial debt outstanding. That tends to be a lot driven by these private equity lenders, as well as the smaller regional players have been funding that a great deal. And those are the ones that are having a lot of stress now on their deposits, and they're having to mark to market as they're seeking to sell assets to raise cash. So it's really this cascading effect that's hitting all aspects of the property market at once. And when you've got this, you know, to some extent, a lasting work from home metrics, so they're just not needing the same space in offices as they did pre-pandemic, what you find is other people that the residential multifamily properties are also having a problem, because if there's not the same amount of workers needing to be right downtown, there's a lot of people saying, well, why would we have so little space and pay so much rent? Why don't we live, you know, further out? If we don't have to be there every day, we only have to commute maybe 2 or 3 days a week. So all of a sudden, the flexibility that is afforded people just at a time when prices and rents were so obscene in many urban areas. So all of these pressures are pushing people to be more efficient and come up with alternate ideas and solutions to cut costs. And, you know, ultimately that's all good, because to be more efficient and careful with funds is ultimately a very good thing.
Are there ways to manage risk exposure?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I've basically talked about some of them, but, you know, having cash is an excellent thing to have right now in, you know, deposits yielding more than 4%. That's great. As the inflation rate is coming down, and it certainly is, right? We're seeing that all kinds of things, not just consumer prices, but producer prices as well, are coming off the boil significantly from the peak in June. So the real yields that you can obtain on cash-like deposits and short-term bonds and that sort of thing is all pretty attractive right now. Also, the the impetus to increase your savings and reduce your debt is very staggering right now. So that's a good thing. You know, we had these bad incentives before where people were encouraged to borrow rather than save because of the perversity of the interest rate structure. But now we have the opposite. So, you know, whatever you can do to reduce your overhead in terms of superfluous expenses, to be consolidate and to be smarter with money, this is all great. This is an opportunity to change. Potentially, you could change your habits for the rest of your life and be benefited by them. You know, look at things that are extraneous spending you don't need to maintain. This includes, for example, extra properties. You know, a lot of people bought recreational or secondary properties during the COVID shutdown, and those were negative yielding properties. The overhead is, there's no cash flow coming in, or there's insufficient cash flow to pay for the costs. That this is not too late to look at some of that and say, you know, do we really need these excessive outlays and extra costs, or do we want to reduce that so that we can save more? So those are things that people can do. And also just keeping in mind what I'm describing here about the historical norms around the equity market. If you're still heavily invested in the equity market, trying to look through this recession, appreciate that the bulk of the losses have not yet been seen. So if you've found a rough ride in the last year and you haven't enjoyed watching your account values come down as some of these main sectors have begun to deflate, appreciate that we're not very likely through it and that the bulk of it is still ahead of us. So that may help you decide to lower your exposure to some of the you know, the high-risk assets. And unfortunately, the sales side of the investment community has the bulk of people's portfolios in the highest fee-generating products for themselves, which means they have a lot of risk exposure. And that's not in a customer's best interest, and it's not in an individual's best interest, especially at this point in the cycle.
I noticed a statistic, rents in Canada up nearly 11% in the past year, and we had over a million people added to the Canadian population. Can we house these people, and can we do it affordably?
Well, there's a lot of supply coming online. There's record actual multifamily supply coming online in terms of rentals in the next year and two. So that will help to a large degree. But I think there will be also, as I described, consolidation of a lot of people will be, you know, sharing. Some of my children's friends, my kids are in their early 20s, and I've seen some of this in their peer group where, you know, rent leases are coming up for renewal, and landlords are looking to increase rents by $500 or $600 a month because the rate of their mortgage has gone up, or they're on floating rate, or they're looking to renew, and so they're trying to catch up for their negative cash flow by boosting the rents. Well, that kind of rental increase is not absorbable by the vast majority of people, and so what it's prodding is for these people to look for, you know, either sharing accommodation with someone else, moving in with family, you know, moving to cheaper areas. So ultimately, you can't get blood from a stone. And if people do not have the cash flow or ability to afford, you know, really high rents, you will not be renting. And that will in itself ultimately bring down the price that is, you know, the market price for rental accommodation.
Danielle, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Hey, thank you.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her website's jugglingdynamite.com and venablepark.com. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Eric Haddock, and Danielle Park. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.